His topic today is Washington Issues for Broadcast Engineers. And so anyway, let's welcome David up here, and let's get the program going.
Good morning. Wow, everybody's up early for the lawyer. That's what you want at 8 a.m. I mean, I did the session last night that started at 7:30 and went till about 9 o'clock, and I'm looking for the brats and beer this morning, right? Isn't that what we really want to start the morning off, especially when we're talking about legal issues from Washington? Because, you know, that's probably the last thing that you want to hear. Hey, I'm here from Washington, and I'm here to help you, right? Because you know that there's always stuff going on from Washington that you don't want to hear about. And some of the stuff I'll be talking about here today will be stuff that you don't want to hear about. Some of it hopefully will be stuff that isn't too bad. But it's all stuff about what you need to be watching out for, what you need to be tracking in Washington to see how it affects your day-to-day life and the possibilities that you've got for future changes in your broadcast operations. Now, how many radio guys are in the audience here today? Wow, how many TV? Are there any TV? Okay, there are TV. Mixed group, that's good, because I've got both radio and TV issues here. And I've got this big clock in front of me that's counting down each second that I go off and say something weird. I'm like, oh no, it's a second less that I've got to talk about the substance. So let's just dive right in. And if I get to something that you've got a question about, just jump up and down, and we'll try to take them as we go along and hopefully have a minute or two left at the end for just other questions as they come along. First of all, let's talk about the FCC. You're one of the first audiences that I can say since the Biden administration came in 2021 is that we've got a full commission. We've got five commissioners that have been seated. There's been a vacancy since 2021 while they were fighting over that fifth commissioner. The FCC was tied at two Republicans and two Democrats, which basically meant they couldn't do anything really controversial. They were doing housekeeping stuff that they had to get done, things like reg fees, certain security issues that weren't controversial on a political basis, but things like changing the ownership rules that some of you may be talking about with your owners of your broadcast stations, about whether you can own more radio stations in a market, whether TV stations in a market can combine, particularly the stations outside the top one or two stations in the market. Those have all been on hold while we've had this 2-2 Republican and Democratic divide. But now we've got a five-person commission when Ana Gomez was approved 2 weeks ago. The other two commissioners, Commissioners Starks and Carr, Starks's term would have ended this year, Carr's next year. They've been both approved for full five-year terms. So we will have a full commission right through the election next year. Unless somebody resigns. And that means they can move forward on things like ownership, where I'm not looking for any major changes with a Democratic administration. I think things will stay the way that they are, even though the FCC has now been ordered to get a decision out that they've been sitting on for 5 years to get a decision out in the next 90 days by December 27th. So everybody will open their stockings on December 25th, then run into the office to finish that order that's got to be out by December 27th on the ownership rules. I expect that there'll be more EEO regulations adopted by this commission. I think that they may even go back and look at some of the paperwork reduction that you saw in the Pai administration, getting rid of a lot of the technical and operational rules that were deregulated in the Pai administration. So watch how this plays out, because I expect we'll be seeing things coming out of the FCC quickly now that they've got a full five-person FCC. But beyond just the FCC, there's the state of Washington generally. And unless you've been hiking in the Andes Mountains outside of the reach of any sort of communications facility, you know that things in Washington, D.C. are a little crazy right now. not much is happening because everybody's fighting with each other. It's probably never been as politicized as it is right now. The government didn't shut down last week, which was good news for all the government workers in Washington, D.C., good news for any of you who had applications pending that had to be approved for changes in facilities or sales of stations or anything along those lines. But government funding runs out again on November 17th. And now with the arguments in the Republican side of the House of Representatives about who's going to be running the place, whether the government funding, whether they're going to get around to deciding government funding by November 17th is up in the air. And if that doesn't get decided, we could see things shutting down again in Washington. So if you've got a modification application that you were waiting to get approved, any sort of technical fix on any of your stations that you were hoping to implement quickly, call your attorney, call your Washington contacts, get that done before November 17th, because if the government shuts down, who knows how long it will be shut down and your applications will be sitting there while those issues are out there. There are other things that the budget bill will contain, like auction authority. We'll talk about new windows for filing applications in a few moments, but one of the things that's in the budget bill is a reauthorization of the FCC's spectrum auction authority. Right now, they can't do a translator window. They can't do an LPFM, LPTV window. They can't do a window for new FM allocations, and there are a few of them. They can't do a window for the few new commercial TV applications because they don't have auction authority. And if you've got commercial band new station applications, they're ultimately decided by auction if more than one person files for the same frequency. And right now, the FCC doesn't have any authority from Congress to conduct an auction. So we'll talk about a number of other specific issues here, a whole list of issues that you ought to be aware of that I'll be running through quickly here. Let's start with that EAS test. Hopefully you all had an EAS test last week, right? Yeah, good. Thumbs up. I was sitting in the United Lounge at Chicago O'Hare Airport at 1:20, and I coming back from a state broadcasters convention in the Midwest, kind of had forgotten that it was that day, and suddenly at 1:20, beep, everybody's cell phone in that United Club went off all at once, and everybody's jumping up, what's going on here? And I'm, oh yeah, I should know about this stuff. Hopefully you filed your Form 1 last week that said whether or not you got the test, and you remember by November 20th to file you filed Form 2 last week to say whether or not you got the test, and we'll file Form 3 by November 20th, giving details about the quality of the test and any problems that you had during the course of the test. This is important for the broadcast industry. We'll be talking about AM radio in the next session. The whole idea behind preserving AM in the car, and ultimately, we're going to be talking about preserving FM in the car, I think, in a couple of years. The reason that Congress has been so receptive to preserving AM in the car is because of the role AM plays in the emergency alert system. If AM stations and other stations don't take the time to participate in nationwide EAS tests and to file the reports from those tests, how can you really make the argument to Congress, oh yeah, we're really important to the emergency alert system, but yeah, we can't be bothered with filing those forms. So get those in. If there were problems, fix those problems so that the next time that there's an EAS test, everything works and we can say, yeah, we are part of the emergency alert system. We are an important part of the emergency alert system and really, really can get messages out to the public. A couple of other EAS issues to be concerned about. There is a default to cap requirement that kicks in December that requires that when you get an EAS alert from the DAISY chain over the air system, that first your system pulls the internet delivered common alerting protocol, internet delivered alert, and broadcasts that alert rather than the one that you've gotten for over the air, because the quality is supposed to be better. And it's supposed to pull IPAWS, that's hard to say first thing in the morning, pull IPAWS, the internet delivered alert system, to see if that alert has come in on the IPAWS system for at least 10 seconds before rebroadcasting the over-the-air system. Now, I understand from some of the exhibitors at this conference and others that there is at least one of the EAS alert systems that hasn't yet updated their boxes to do that polling of the internet system first and putting those alerts over the air. So make sure that your system has been updated and you're ready to go, because there is an effective date in December on that. Also, for those of you who were here for Brats and Beer last night when we were talking about security, I mentioned that the FCC has also got a rulemaking under the guise of making sure that nobody hacks your EAS system and puts zombie alerts, talking about the rise of the zombies that happened to a couple of TV stations back in 2015, that they can't hack your systems. The FCC's got a rulemaking that I think is likely to be adopted that will require every broadcast station to take actions to make sure that their systems are secure, that people can't hack your systems, or at least that you've adopted the kind of security protocols that are expected for most regulated businesses, to make sure that you've done something to make sure that you're not going to be hacked. And that people can't get access to the EAS system. Likely, you're going to have to report every year about the steps that you've taken to make sure that you can't be hacked. And if you do, in fact, get hacked, so that people get access to your internal systems and potentially to EAS, you've got to report it to the FCC within 24 or 48 hours. The FCC is yet to decide how quickly that will be. Look for that rulemaking, because I imagine that's going to be coming here in the next couple of months, putting obligations on you to make sure that you secure your systems. Another big proceeding pending at the FCC is an increase in digital power, so that your HD channels on FM can have better building penetration, fill in your service area better than they currently do. The proposal was advanced by NAB and NPR, pushing to adopt a higher power level for the HD broadcast or digital broadcasts on FM. Generally, most parties seem to say, yeah, let's go ahead and do it, FCC. We think it's important. There are a couple of folks, though, that are worried about first adjacent channel interference, and talked about how the FCC ought to allow a process where people can complain and possibly cut back some of those power increases if, in fact, they do create interference to closely spaced FM stations on first adjacent channels. Part of this proposal is also to have asymmetrical sidebands, so if you've got a station above you on a first adjacent channel that's very closely spaced, where you might create interference or might not have enough spacing to increase power under the standards that the FCC is proposing, but you don't have one below you on the dial, that you can increase that sideband to a higher level and still get some of the benefits from this increased power. If the comments are in, watch for an FCC decision there in the next couple of months as well. For TV stations especially, there is another spectrum grab. Everybody remembers the C-band that we just finished going through in the last year, where you got paid because wireless folks came and took some of the C-band so that they could use it for 5G spectrum. Well, there's another one going on with the 13 gigahertz band that's currently used for STLs and for electronic news gathering equipment. By November 29th, all of you that are using that spectrum need to certify to the FCC that the information on your licenses for the use of that spectrum is correct. And if it's not correct, by November 29th, you need to correct it. And if you don't correct it, as the FCC looks at repacking this band or taking this band for other wireless uses, you won't be protected. You won't get any sort of compensation if you've got to move, or your channels won't be protected from any wireless users that might ultimately get permission to use that frequency. So watch that November 29th date if you're using that band for any of your operations. AM radio, we're doing a whole session next on AM radio, so I'm not going to talk here much about the pending congressional proposals for AM. Just pointing out that there are still proposals for technical changes in AM, loosening some of the protections for the clear channel stations, that small C clear channel, not the company that used to be known as Clear Channel, formerly known as Clear Channel, for some of those high-powered FM stations so that local stations can increase power at night in particular. Those don't seem to be going anywhere because, hey, a lot of people like listening to those 50-kilowatt stations at night hundreds of miles away from where they are, especially in rural areas where there may not be a local AM that will improve from a nighttime signal. There are other ideas that pop up from time to time, like for those of you AM operators who also have FM translators, where the FM translator really has become the primary service in your area, maybe getting rid of some of those AM stations that cost so much to upkeep and where the land may be more valuable than the station at this point. Maybe just keep the translator, right? And get rid of that AM, give that spectrum back to the FCC and let them do something else with it. Those proposals don't seem to be going any place at all, but we may talk more about that in the next session. ATSC-3 on the TV side of things. Some of the issues have recently been resolved about who's got liability for the use of lighthouse stations that you've got to keep in ATSC-1 when you convert, that broadcast your primary signal to those folks who haven't gotten the new ATSC-3 receivers yet. That requirement that you continue to broadcast your primary signal on some partner station in ATSC-1 when you've converted will be in place at least through 2027, as will the requirement that the current technical parameters for ATSC-3 stay in place. The idea had been originally that ATSC-3 could evolve, just like, you know, your mobile phones. You're always getting updates to your Apple phone or your Google phone or whatever phone. They're always updating it, right? The FCC is not approving those updates. It's just something that comes along with the technology. The idea was that's how ATSC would work. Once a technological fix came along, they would just upload it. They wouldn't get FCC approval. Right now, through at least 2027, FCC approval would be required before any changes, and we'll see what happens in 2027. There's still lots of business issues, and I'm sure will be talked about here and are talked about in other sessions, about how to use ATSC-3, whether to use it for localized services, data transmissions, mobile applications, even audio, even you radio guys. There's been proposals. Sinclair has been talking about using it for a multi-channel audio service in some of their markets to compete with the XM Siriuses or the Spotifys of the world by delivering it through the ATSC-3 spectrum. You know, where that will go, where the business case will ultimately shake out, who knows? But those are all issues that you should be watching. The FCC has also got a proceeding about patent protection. And when that first came out, everybody kind of shrugged their shoulders and said, who cares, right? The system's out there. People are implementing. Patents don't seem to be a big issue until, what was it, 2 weeks ago, when LG suddenly said, hey, we're not going to be manufacturing sets with ATSC-3 receivers because a new patent entity that claims that it owns a couple of patents that are essential for our ATSC-3 TV manufacturing for those receivers that we would send out. They own the patent and are asking for a lot more money than all the rest of the patent holders that have given us the authority to put their materials into our systems. So LG said, we're just not going to manufacture sets at least for another year. That may roll out to affect other TV manufacturers. I've heard that some of them are not affected, but let's see how that plays out, because that could be an important issue if other patent owners come up and start making claims against other manufacturers as well. Watch, too, that the FCC and NAB working groups that really include members from the entire industry, from manufacturers, from public interest groups, from other trade associations, are all part of working groups to talk about the future of television, how to roll out ATSC3, how to make the rules for television more amenable to new technologies, what to do about issues like these patent issues. There are working groups on all sorts of issues that are supposed to report back to the FCC by June of next year to talk about other ways that the FCC can encourage the rollout of new TV technologies. So watch as reports begin to come out of those committees next year as to where that will lead. There are also FM technology proposals still on the table that have been out there for a long time. The geo broadcast solution proposal for zone casting to allow you to take boosters within your big FM signal and do boosters in different parts of your service area where the booster would originate some limited amount of original programming, maybe commercials, maybe news in those parts of your service area. So in northern suburbs of Madison, you could do an ad for one car dealer. In the southern suburbs, you could do an ad for a different car dealer during the same spot break. There have been lots and lots of arguments about this. Some of the big broadcasters have argued that this should not be adopted because it's going to create more FM noise, if nothing else. Supposedly, the geo broadcast solution folks say that they've solved those problems or minimized those problems, but some broadcasters are not particularly convinced of that. Other broadcasters in smaller markets, especially outside of major metro areas, are worried that it really upsets the balance of operations. If suddenly the big broadcast station, who can't really sell to the local hardware store or the local car dealer in some suburban markets because those companies can't afford to pay the big market prices for advertising, if suddenly they can pop a booster into your town and start selling to those local merchants and taking money away from those suburban stations, that really upsets the localism that the FCC has encouraged over the years. So there's a big battle, and the geo broadcast solutions folks are in there at the FCC regularly saying, hey, please approve our system, approve our system, while the NAB and others have been arguing, not so fast, let's hold off on that. So that has been pending for almost 4 years now, ripe for a decision by the FCC. So at some point, they're going to have to decide on that and see how that rolls out. There's also a proposal on the table for C4s, a class of FM station between the 6-kilowatt Class A's and the C3s at 25 kilowatts, somewhere around 12 kilowatts, that the proponents say would better allow better building penetration and otherwise allow stations to serve their local areas with stronger signals. Opponents argue, again, more noise in the FM band that's already getting very congested. Lots of FM translators might be bounced by stations going from a Class A to a Class C4. And that's been held up as well for about 4 years at the FCC. That's only a notice of inquiry. The geo broadcast solutions idea, the zone casting, that could be approved or disapproved at any time. The C4s, that's just a notice of inquiry that came out from the FCC. They would still have to come out with a formal notice of proposed rulemaking, take a whole new set of comments, and then take months more to make any final decision on that. So we're not looking at anything on C4s for at least a year, if not longer. Other issues to watch out for. I talked about auction authority. The FCC doesn't have the authority to open up a translator window, doesn't have an authority to open up an LPTV window, both of which have been promised to come at some point in the near future, but because they would involve auctions, and the FCC can't right now conduct an auction, they can't announce the start of any of those windows. So what did they do? They started an LPFM window. Non-commercial applicants for LPFMs, for low-power FMs, don't need auctions. They're decided through a point system if there are mutually exclusive applications filed for the same frequencies in the same areas. In early November, those applications will be filed. If you're a nonprofit group looking for an opportunity, hey, the low-power window in early November. But if you're a FM operator, also watch those applications that are filed, because those applicants can ask for second adjacent channel waivers to stick some of those LPFMs in tight places, especially in the bigger markets where there's not a lot of spectrum availability. And they can make proposals that sometimes can be seen to create interference to your stations. So watch who files in your area and make sure that they're not doing anything that could create any interference to any of your operations. Other issues to watch, enforcement issues. The FCC, especially when they've been a 2-2 FCC, where they couldn't do big policy issues, what did they do? They concentrated on the issues that were there based on the rules that were already in place. And they looked at a lot of enforcement issues. One of the issues has been cracking down on stations that aren't operating with the facilities that they're supposed to be operating with. You know, if your station has a transmitter that's having problems, if an antenna has been hit by lightning, 10 days. If you're operating at a power less than what you're authorized at, you got to notify the FCC. 30 days, you got to ask for permission through special temporary authority if you're off the air or not operating at the power with the facilities that you've been authorized in your license to do. And I know a lot of times engineers say, oh, that equipment, that part, whatever it is that's ordered, yeah, the manufacturer says he's going to have it to me next week. So no problem. I don't have to tell the FCC. I'll have it fixed within 10 days. But nothing ever comes when it's supposed to, right? And once it comes, it's not the right part, and you don't get it installed, and it doesn't get fixed, and that suddenly that 30 days has passed, and you're operating illegally. And if anybody turns you in, if there's any interference issues, or anybody otherwise discovers that you're not operating with the facilities that you're supposed to be operating with, you suddenly have FCC problems. One of the areas where this has been a particular concern has been FM translators. You know, with the explosion of FM translators that we've seen in the last 10 years for non-commercial FMs, for AM rebroadcasts, for HD channel rebroadcast on translators, everybody seems to have a translator, right? And lots of those translators don't seem to be operating with the power that they're authorized or with the antenna for which they're authorized or at the height at which they're authorized or from the transmitter site at which they've been authorized. And there have been cases all over the place where the FCC has been fining translator operations or shutting down translator operations because people are operating in the wrong place with the wrong power, with the wrong antenna, doing something that's wrong. Make sure that you're using what you're supposed to be using in those facilities. Check out your auxiliaries, too. We've been finding more and more auxiliaries, studio transmitter links, remote pickups, inner city relays that aren't operating on the right frequencies, that have transmission paths that have changed over the years. Your studio once was at 240 Main Street, and now you're out in the suburbs. Did you file a change with the FCC so that your transmission location for that STL is now at the plaza out in the suburbs rather than down on Main Street? There is this one engineer that probably some of you have heard from, a guy out in California who's made it his life's mission to go through all the auxiliary databases and write letters to stations or send emails saying, hey, I looked at the database and it says that you've got a STL here when I think it's out here, or it doesn't have a transmitter receive location at all so that you're not protected. The FCC is looking at cleaning up some of those databases, but you should do it yourself first to make sure that you don't have any interference problems, that when somebody drops in an STL remote pickup using some of those frequencies that you think that you've got protection for, or that you've coordinated with other people, or where it comes up sometimes is sales of broadcast stations. You've got an inner city relay path that has three hops through three different towers to get to an auxiliary studio or a satellite station or a translator down the road. And those were authorized 30 years ago. And instead of going from here to here to there, it actually now goes here to there to there. And you forgot to change the here to there. The buyer suddenly looks, oh my gosh, this is in the wrong place, and it's been there for 30 years. It's an FCC issue that the FCC can have problems that you haven't been in the right place for 30 years. Silent stations, or even stations that are operating at the wrong location. The FCC, there is a rule section, or it's not a rule, it's part of the statute, 312G of the Communications Act. You're all writing that down, right, so that you can be lawyers. 312G. It's an important section of the rules because it says if you've not been operating for a full year, your license is automatically forfeited. So if you take that AM that had all sorts of problems and you're going to move it to a different site or figure out what to do with it later and you take it silent, if it's off the air for more than a year, license is canceled automatically with very, very limited exceptions. About the only exceptions that the FCC has been recognizing is if a hurricane comes in and levels an entire area and somebody can't get back on the air within a year. But generally, if you can't get on the air within a year, you lose your license. Translator licenses have been canceled. But the FCC has expanded that, so they're reading that rule to say that if you're not operating from where you're authorized to operate for a year, you lose your license. There was a religious college in Virginia that just lost the license because they got an STA when their transmitter, they lost their transmitter site. They moved to a different site, got an STA to operate from that different site. That STA expired. They never renewed it. Then they actually moved back to a new location near the original site, but it wasn't the original site, where they're operating for 5 years until somebody came along and said, this is not the right place. And when the FCC investigated, ultimately they said, actually since that STA expired 5 years ago, we've been operating from this other site that isn't authorized. But, you know, we thought it was close enough to the original site that we didn't need any authority. The FCC said, no, it was a different site. You needed authority. You're operating. You're admitting that you're operating there for 5 years. That was not authorized operation. You lose your license. And that's been a constant theme over the last couple of years. You're operating from an unauthorized site for more than a year. It's the same thing as not being on the air at all, and they'll take your license away. So if you've got changes, make sure you get them approved by the FCC. Another issue that's been a problem, we just saw a station down in Maryland get a nasty gram from the FCC saying, hey, your tower lights are out. And your tower lights were out a year ago when we came by with our inspectors when somebody reported you. And they're still not operating. And nobody's bothered to tell the FAA that those tower lights haven't been operating. What are you going to do about it? And by the way, your tower registration that's filed with the FCC says this address is 240 Main Street, but we think it's some other address on out in the fields of that town. What are you going to do to fix all this stuff? And once you tell us what you're going to do, we'll come back to you with how much you're going to owe us for the fines for not doing what you are supposed to be doing. That guy's likely to get fined a lot by the FCC. But even beyond the fine issue, if you've got tower lights that are out and an airplane, heaven forbid, flies into that tower, the liability can be astronomical if that wasn't reported to the FAA. You're required to report to the FAA if those required tower lights are out right away so they can issue a notice to all the aircraft in the area to make sure that they know that there's an unlit tower in a particular area. I had a client probably 20 years ago who had an unlit tower that they had reported to the FAA. There was a failure of all the tower lights, and they reported it to the FAA, and a military aircraft about a week later ran into that tower and somebody was killed. They had done what they were supposed to do. They had notified the FAA. The FAA had noticed, sent out the notice, and somehow the military guys just didn't get the notice and pay attention to that tower, and there wasn't liability. But if they hadn't notified the FAA and the FAA hadn't put out that notice, there would have been millions of dollars of liability to that station. So if those lights go out, let the FAA know right away. Watch other issues. Now, I know you guys probably aren't responsible for all of the online public inspection file. Oh, on towers also, this guy up in Maryland who got fined also got fined because his tower hadn't been painted the right colors. Remember all those paint chip cards that you're supposed to go out and compare? The FCC actually did that. It seemed like I haven't seen those in a couple of years, but they went out there with the paint comparisons and said, this doesn't look anything like the paint on these chip cards, and that's another issue that guy's going to have to face. Make sure people don't want to spend money, especially on AM towers, but it can cost you money from FCC fines and other liability issues if you don't keep up those tower lights and tower painting. But also the online public and file is important. I know sometimes you guys as engineers get the responsibility to make sure stuff gets uploaded, particularly in political season. And rumor is there's some election or something next year. You might have heard something about that. There's going to be lots of political money, especially in a state here like Wisconsin. That's going to be a battleground state where you've got a Senate race as well as the presidential race and lots of congressional races and local races going on. There is going to be lots of political money spent. Make sure that documents get uploaded when orders come in for political time, that they get uploaded within one business day. Make sure that you're working with your sales department so they know how to access the public inspection file, that you've got the ability to get those documents in when they're required. The FCC's been fining stations all over the place for not keeping public inspection file documentation, quarterly issues programs list, EEO public inspection file reports, not getting those into the public file at the time they're supposed to be in the public file. So coordinate with all the folks at your stations that are supposed to be doing that to make sure that they know how to do it, that the passwords are kept secure, that you're changing those passwords so that when somebody who has access to that system leaves the station, they can't keep uploading stuff that you don't necessarily want uploaded to your public inspection file, because we've heard some of those stories about somebody who left on not so good terms from a station putting stuff into the public inspection file after they left, and station being surprised to find all sorts of goodies in that public inspection file. Make sure that you're coordinating with people to avoid those issues. The station log, people don't think of a station log, because back in the day you had to monitor your parameters every 3 hours and write it down on a log and all that. I see some gray hair out here that everybody probably remembers, but you still do have to update your station log anytime the station's not operating the way it's supposed to be operating, talking about what you're doing, talking about EAS tests, talking about anything else that's out of the ordinary at your station. You're supposed to be keeping these logs on a weekly basis. You're supposed to be signing them by your chief operator. Yeah, you're supposed to have a chief operator, too. Remember, somebody's supposed to be designated at each station in writing as the chief operator for that station, signing these station logs either manually or electronically every week to make sure the tower lights are operating, EAS tests have been received, and any problems with the stations have been reported. When there's an issue, when somebody reports you for not having operated a station on a regular basis, for not having your tower lights on, for operating with facilities that are out of compliance with what's on your license, for not rebroadcasting EAS tests. If you're reported, what's the first thing the FCC asks for? Your station logs, in which all this stuff is supposed to be reported. And I don't know how many times I've had a client get one of those letters from the FCC and say, I say, send me the station logs so we can provide them to the FCC. The station what? Yeah, you got to have station logs even these days, even though it doesn't have a whole lot of information out there. TV side, captioning is another big area where the FCC is watching. Complaints about the accuracy of captioning, make sure your captions are going to any programming that you're doing on the air that is then transferred to online usage. Make sure that you've got your systems in place so that if you're running weather alerts during entertainment programming on your secondary audio channel, you're doing an audio version of those visual alerts that are running outside of news programming on that SAP channel so that folks who can't read it can still hear that alert is happening. COMACT concerns. The FCC has expressed concerns that those loud commercials that you're not supposed to do based on the law that was passed 7 or 8 years ago are coming back. And I think a lot of that perception is because of online usage or some of the streaming services or some of the cable services where some of the commercials that are dropped in are at extraordinarily different audio levels. I was in a hotel room at a state convention 2 weeks ago, and I think it was a DirecTV system. A local ad was dropped in at incredible volume. I think I woke up the people 3 rooms down from my hotel room when the local car dealer ad was dropped into this TV program that I was watching on one of the cable channels on carried by DirecTV. And I think you get blamed for it. But the FCC has expressed concern, so make sure all your systems are operational and that you're keeping those loud commercials down. Video description for your TV stations is expanding 10 markets every year until they get to the 212th market. So watch as you're in a smaller market where you haven't had to pass through the video description. It's now called audio description of the video programming, where that programming is described for those folks who have visual impairments, described in an audio way. You're supposed to be passing through network programming for a particular number of hours per week, and that each year expands by 10 markets into the small markets. Plenty of issues for you all to worry about. The FCC is not doing random inspections, but people are regularly getting turned in and regularly being found out because issues come up in one way or another that you don't really think about without the FCC having those field inspectors driving around your markets, dropping in unexpectedly. These compliance issues, as I mentioned, are important for sales, for financings, for any sort of place where your owner is doing a due diligence of station operations. They want to know that everything is operational. They don't want unpleasant surprises when they're trying to sell a station, finding that there are all sorts of problems out there. Tower lights and other issues, spurious emissions that create interference to FAA frequencies or other frequencies have been big problems as well, where the FCC is really concerned if they create issues where there are potential threats to life or others. Those alternate broadcast inspection programs that the Wisconsin broadcasters and others do, even though there's not those random FCC inspections on a regular basis that there used to be, still a great way to have somebody else from the outside check your systems to make sure everything looks compliant with what the FCC is requiring. It's good insurance to have, so you should be doing it. Compliance is everyone's job at the station. Make sure that you're paying attention to what you're doing. Look at that, 32 seconds. How about that? I should be on TV or something, right? Talking right up to the end. Here's my commercial message. This is where you can find me. I do the hotline for the Wisconsin broadcasters where I answer easy questions that I can answer in one email or one telephone call if you need any help. Also, there's my blog, Broadcast Law Blog, where I write about a lot of these issues on a weekly, if not more often, basis. Thank you. Perfect. Oh, right on zero.